Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Signal from Christians in Media. I'm your host, James Poulter. I'm joined again, once again, in the studio with my very good friends, the Dame Ruth Jackson.
Hi.
And not quite yet,
but
we'll work on that. And editor of Christianity Magazine, Mr. Sam Hales.
Ha ha. Oh, wait, you're not joking. I am actually editor. Yeah, hello. Hello.
Did you forget your job title?
Yeah, you're quite right. I had to pinch myself in. Hello, nice to see you.
Still imposter syndrome still.
It's looming large.
In Sam's life. maybe he's feeling slightly ropey after having not run the London Marathon at the weekend, trying to kind of keep up with that. Both of you have achieved massive running feats in your life. Ruth up a mountain, Sam round a marathon.
I've done the marathon too.
You've done the marathon as well.
Yeah. I've done neither of those things.
And
I
Ruth
think
ran
you
it.
Are fools.
Ruth ran it considerably quicker than I did. As well.
I'm basically a better person.
That's what we're going to take from this conversation.
I'm glad that we've established that early on. Today on the show, we're going to be talking about being better people and what that usually qualifies as with some of the news stories that are making the headlines at the moment. We're going to be talking about the diversity panel as Jeff Norcott, who is the rather right-leaning comedian, has been appointed to the panel along with other people that have been on this show, like June Sarpong. We'll be talking about that. We're also going to be talking about the ongoing protests from Extinction Rebellion, warning of the current climate crisis and what the Christian response to that might look like, and the movie that is making all of the headlines right now, which is the Avengers Endgame, the film in the end of this at least sequence of big Marvel movies that has smashed all box office records. We're going to be talking about whether or not superheroes are still our idols, and some other stuff about schools and parenting that's going to get Ruth rather excited. So that's all coming up after the notices. So, like in all good services, we need to have the notices. And these are some things that you might want, dates for your diaries, things that are coming up. This year, we are changing up things slightly in the Christians in Media calendar and giving you, rather than one big thing to look forward to at the back end of the year, which is usually the Church and Faith Conference, this year we're giving you three different things to look forward to over the next couple of months. So let's put those out there. The first of which is the Christians in Media sessions. That is a morning of workshops and facilitated discussions, which is going to be hosted on Thursday, the 27th of June at Carlton House Terrace in London. And you can come along and hear from people like a panel on media ethics, which will be facilitated by the BBC's very own Sally Bundock, previous guest on the show. And also you can come and hear from Sheridan Voysey talking about the four elements of compelling storytelling. And we've also got, which I think will be very interesting for many of you, a discussion on work-life balance and avoiding burnout with Action Jackson, which is about the best name you could possibly ask
That's
for.
That's excellent. I really hope we're related.
I do too. And you may well be. So that is coming up on the 27th of June. Later on in the year, you can also go along to the next of our breakfast briefing sessions with Julie Etchingham from ITV. She'll be hosting a fireside chat there in September. Again, more information about that up on Eventbrite and also on the website. And the big event later in the year is our main church service for Christians in Media happening in October. A little way out now at the moment, but we'll be bringing together an ecumenical service for Christians working in the media from all across the country at All Souls Langham Place on Thursday the 10th of October. That's an evening event, and you can find all the information for those things up on the events page at christiansinmedia.co.uk, and you can find tickets for all three of those over on Eventbrite. All of those, I believe, are free events. No, the first two cost you money, the last one's free, but all reasonably priced, and you can find them there. Okay, well, that is the notices for now. Of course, if you want to connect with us on the show, you can always do that. Go and use the hashtag Signal, and you can tweet that to us at Christians in Media over on Twitter. You can also join the Christians in Media Facebook group. We would love to chat to you there. Okay, on with the news. Okay, this month's news, there is lots to get through, and let's start off with talking about the current, controversy, I suppose, that's been created by the appointment of Jeff Norcott to the BBC's Diversity Panel. Now, if you're not familiar with Jeff's work, he is a regular contributor to things like The MASH Report on BBC Two with Nish Kumar. He's also appeared on many of the big panel shows and is a comedian in his own right, and is particularly notable for probably being the only openly conservative comedian on the circuit. Well, that's certainly the way in which he styles himself. And he has been appointed to a new BBC Diversity and Inclusion panel with four other folks. And that is basically kind of there to balance out a bunch of people who are actually from predominantly what would be considered minorities. How do we feel about this, guys? Well, the balancing out, you know, do we have to have everyone represented for it to be truly diverse?
I don't think you necessarily need a white conservative person for it to be a good diverse panel, because that's the norm within the BBC often, isn't it? Possibly not the conservative, but the white male. And therefore, I think if you've got a diversity panel, you're presumably liaising with commissioners, controllers, that sort of thing, and they will tend to be white men, not always men, but they will tend to be largely white, I would imagine, and therefore you're bringing in that diverse element there. So I think I would probably go heavy on the ethnic minorities, because not in a tokenistic way at all, but in a way that you need to represent those, because everything else is being represented in the normative.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, when you look at the balance, or at least the reasoning behind this, obviously there's a few different things that are supposedly being pointed to. One, that he comes from predominantly a working class background, which obviously isn't, I think, often lobbied at the BBC, is not always representative of people coming from working class backgrounds. So I think that may be fair. Also, because he is someone who is voting for Brexit also, which is something that the BBC has been accused on a number of occasions recently of having a slightly more Remain point of view. So there may be something going on here. Reacting to this story from The Spectator earlier in the week, Ross Clark wrote a very interesting comment blog on The Spectator. You can go and find that yourself under Why Jeffrey Norcott Won't Last on the BBC's Diversity Panel. He's giving it 48 hours at time of writing, and he's still there as far as we're aware, but made out the point that it's not that you'll have said or done anything in that kind of time period, but you can't simply have a straight white man, simply one that backs Brexit, on a diversity panel, because it misunderstands the concept of diversity altogether, which is that if it exists only for the promotion of professional victims, he's saying, which I think is maybe kind of overstating the facts. Sam, what do you think about this? Is it right that, you know, someone who is representing that kind of view, that whilst in the majority in the country is often seen as the minority in the media, is appointed to something like this?
Well, I kind of want to take a massive step back and just acknowledge, I think, what we already know, but it's worth saying, is that you're never going to have a completely balanced panel in every way. You know, when you take into class, race, gender, sexuality, there's all these different ways that we now say, well, this is diverse, this is not diverse. And sometimes it can feel like categories are being added almost every sort of month or year that goes by. You know, another minority group will say, hang on, our rights, our interests aren't being represented, and we're a minority too. And so I do have some sympathy with this sort of question of, where's it all going? Because yes, we should all work for a fair, a just and equal society, of course. No one's saying we shouldn't. But at the same time, where do you kind of draw the line on all these different competing interests and competing minorities? And I kind of just feel sorry for anyone who's involved in some of these discussions around diversity, because I think it could be a real head scratcher. And I've had this as an editor of a magazine. You sort of look at it, you think, right, we've been really balanced on gender, we've been really balanced on race, we've been really balanced on different theological viewpoints. And then someone comes along and says, why are you so anti working class? You think, oh my goodness, we haven't balanced class, or whatever it is. You know what I mean? There's so many different things to hold in your head when it comes to diversity, of trying to make sure everything is equal. We're never going to achieve complete equity across all of these different groups. Doesn't mean we shouldn't try, but I do worry sometimes when, because this sort of stuff can understandably generate a lot of anger. And I do understand that if you're part of a minority group, you feel you've been overlooked. I completely get that. At the same time, I think it's difficult. I really do.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, Ross closes out this piece saying that as one former BBC employee might have out it, all people are diverse, but some are more diverse than others. And I suppose that is the big qualifier here, is that what counts as diversity is that you're coming from a small group, is that that group has been particularly oppressed in the past. I mean, I think many people who are supporting Brexit would say that the mainstream media have been somewhat trying to oppress their views of having dared voting for Brexit.
Yeah, and it becomes really interesting when, for example, you take something that people love to argue about, which is question time panelists, and you think, well, how diverse is this group? And of course, historically, I understand the BBC have gone to great lengths to make sure who is on that panel and even who is in the audience is finally balanced between the three major political or even more political parties. Whereas now people are saying, well, do we need to shift the way, for example, those panels and audiences are chosen and base it instead or as well as on how people voted in the Brexit referendum? Because that referendum has changed the political landscape. So again, I go back to my point, these are not simple questions.
And also over-indexing as well. I mean, yeah, you're talking about question time audiences. I think they may be fairly hard pressed this week to go and find a bunch of Change UK supporters to go sit in the audience based upon the rather lackluster launch party that happened this week over in Church House. So, you know, I think if anyone is listening and is one of those ardent supporters, please do get in contact with the show because we'd love to hear from you. And I'm sure that they would probably like to appoint you to a panel of diversity because that's how you're going to get that response up there if you're looking at current precedent. I think that you're absolutely right. Question time or any questions or any of those kind of panel shows right now is a really good case study. There's not a week that goes by without one panelist member or someone or other lobbying at the BBC of saying that they don't, you know, represent all views. So maybe this is a counteract to some of those perspectives. But we've certainly seen that, you know, kind of people taking these things out of context and trying to kind of over-inflate their position.
I mean, I would say those who have argued for greater diversity have been successful in the sense that the BBC now, for example, I think have forbidden male-only panels. That's been the policy for some months, if not years now, hasn't it? So I think those who have lobbied for diversity have actually seen some success in various parts of the media where that sort of thing just won't happen anymore. And I think most of us can agree that's a good thing.
In conjunction with this story, you also highlighted to us this week, Sam, something that's been happening actually related to The Spectator and The New Statesman, this debacle that's been going on around Roger Scruton, who was sacked within hours of The New Statesman's article appearing online that was quoting him or supposedly quoting him for saying a few things out of turn. Do you want to give us the background on this story?
Yeah, quite incredible media story that's been going on and causing a lot of debate. So The New Statesman interviewed Roger Scruton and they published their piece. And as you say, very, very quickly, you know, he was a government advisor. He found himself fired, removed from that job advising the government on house building, really as a result of that New Statesman piece. Next thing you know, The Spectator, which of course is a political rival, is more right-wing than The New Statesman, which is more left-wing. Spectator get hold of the original audio recording of that interview and basically make the case that he's been misquoted or he's been quoted out of context. And this is a great travesty and this is a terrible example, you know, bad media ethics, you name it, all the accusations have been thrown around. And of course, Roger Scruton is more right-wing, might hold some views that some people find very difficult or even offensive. And it kind of raises all those questions again of should those people be allowed to advise government? Where do we draw the line? Has he actually said something racist? Or if we understand this in context, has he not? And so it's one of those where you can find yourself, if you are more left of centre, erring with sort of going with the New Statesman defence, saying no, we did a fair interview. And if you're more right of centre, you find yourself reading The Spectator and thinking this is terrible, this poor guy has been treated really badly. I think one thing we can probably all agree on is the journalist in question, it was actually the deputy editor of The New Statesman, did this interview. He posted a photo of himself with some champagne and a caption along the lines of, oh, isn't it great celebrating that day when you get a government advisor Tory so-and-so fired. I think we can probably all agree that does overstep the line when it comes to professional ethics and boundaries. Yeah. And I think that was the wrong thing to do.
Yeah, I think George Eaton making a slight misstep there, who is the New Statesman.
And he did then delete that post, and I think he was right to do so. But it raises all sorts of questions, doesn't it, about media ethics, about people who hold opinions that we might find uncomfortable. Do they have a right to still advise the government? I mean, we don't have time or space to get into the ins and outs of Roger's views on all these different subjects, but I think it was one to watch for sure.
Did anyone release the audio so that people could decide for themselves whether he did or didn't say whatever he was accused of being said, or was it from both sides, was it someone's interpretation of what he said?
No, it seems to be on both sides it's been, you know, kind of held, and the source of where that leak came from as well has been held down. The Spectator editor Fraser Nelson, who you know, actually will regularly appear on one of those Question Time panels that you mentioned before, has said that he won't be revealing the magazine's source, and said that he could not remember a similar situation where an interview taped like that had been leaked. And I think that that, you know, itself is an interesting precedent here, is we sit in this current kind of climate of things leaking all over the place. Obviously, we've had particularly just this event this morning of the Secretary for Defence, Gavin Williamson, being dismissed by Theresa May from the Cabinet as supposedly being the source, allegedly, of that leak, and now potential criminal investigations following up. Is that leaking all over the place seems to be happening, whether it's in political circles or in journalistic ones. And I think that, you know, the sanctity of something said privately in a room is something that I think that many of us, particularly from an ethics perspective, would try and hold to. I mean, you guys must have to deal with this on a daily basis when going on or off the record with people all the time. And those kind of journalistic precedents are held to. But it does seem that there may be a slight breakdown of this kind of general that, well, what you say in a room doesn't get recorded. And maybe that's attributable by the fact that we're used to being recorded and watched everywhere. It's almost our expectation that someone is recording it and watching it. I think for me, you know, I often get asked a lot of questions by people that have appeared on your own radio stations here at Premier, talking about how to advise people about what they say online, and, you know, or in a room. And I was like, well, actually, you're one screenshot or recording away from, you know, kind of disaster at every turn. So nothing is sacred.
I would say those magic few words off the record still very much hold, though. And it is odds, isn't it, how if anyone says, oh, this is off the record, there is very much an understanding across any journalist worth their salt, you do not then quote that at all. And yet what I found interesting is if someone uses a different form of words, such as, oh, I'd rather if you didn't say that, it all becomes a bit more fuzzy, because you think, well, you'd rather not say that, but my job is to report what you say, whether you like it or not, and whether you think it makes you look bad or not, I have a duty to the audience.
And you've not specifically asked me not to do it.
Yeah, so if someone says, I kind of rather not, you know, especially if it's after the interview, you think that becomes a lot more muddy. And I'm not saying I have a particular policy that applies to every situation. I think that things can change depending on various factors, but whenever someone says this next bit is off the record, I think everyone's agreed you do not then quote that.
That's interesting, though, because obviously you as the journalist asking that question and then someone saying to you, yes, this is off the record, you know, that comes from a precedent of when people was literally sat there with, you know, kind of either a tape cassette recorder in, or, you know, much earlier, just a notebook noting these things down and whether or not you're actually going to quote this person. But with so much of the way in which we actually do our jobs now to capture content, like these things are little snippets of digital files that are often on shared servers picked up by all sorts of people, even here in the living, you know, even here in the studio as I sit, you know, I'm watching the Burley feeds coming in, I'm watching news, but I'm dropping into different, you know, kind of spaces. The idea that that thing said in the sacrosanct kind of space of one person to another has degraded somewhat, has it not? I mean, you know, if I'm the producer sat there and I see that and he said, well, you said it off the record to you, but it didn't say it to me, where do we draw the line?
I don't think that holds any weight at all. I think as soon as someone says off the record, you cannot then quote it. I mean, you're right, with the technology, that may well still go down on tape. And so, like you say, that will still be able to be accessed on a computer somewhere. It will still exist. But because the words off the record were uttered before it, I don't think any journalist worth their salt would ever dare touch it. I think that would be unethical.
And that may be true, but so many people that touch this content nowadays are not the journalists that recorded it. They're not journalists, and therefore maybe don't feel that they have to hold themselves to those ethical boundaries. And I think that you're seeing the same thing go down in, you know, kind of, as we've said, you know, kind of the things that were said in the Security Council meeting that have obviously now leaked about the Huawei thing that's going on in the news at the moment, is that, you know, those things were said in a room that was supposedly secret, but other people are going, well, I'm going to make my own personal judgment about whether or not that should be shared out. So maybe these rules aren't as hard and fast as we would perhaps like them to be. Maybe they're going to degrade over time. We shall see. Okay, well, so two rather big political stories, and the third that we have in the politics section is to really look at this quite astounding ability for protest to kind of go and disrupt public life, which is Extinction Rebellion's ongoing protests here in central London, where we're recording, and I expect probably will go far beyond the reaches of the kind of London bubble. And particularly this question, which was sparked by an article that was made last week in the Church Times, saying that Extinction Rebellion's prophecies are not new. And an interesting kind of comment piece here around actually that, you know, these first kind of things that Extinction Rebellion are saying, the fact that we're on the kind of precipice of, you know, kind of disaster with the environment and climate change, actually are many of these people had founding kind of Christian environmentalism voices of, you know, over 50 years ago. There's a quote here which I think is quite interesting. In 1969, the vicar of Great St Mary's, Cambridge, travelled to Belfast to deliver the Church of Ireland's annual theological lectures, and he began in prophetic mode saying, it seems to be probable that the future of man as a species may be decided in the next half century. And of course, we are now living with those prophecies. The big question, I suppose, for you guys is, you know, or I'd like to ask us all to consider is, you know, how as Christians are we supposed to engage with this idea of protesting in this way about a topic that actually does have quite a lot of controversy around whether or not it's something we need to do right now, disrupting public life? Ruth, would you be out there marching with them?
I think it's really interesting because Extinction Rebellion's intention is to get as many people arrested as possible so that they get as noticed as possible, and therefore, you know, to raise the awareness in the most extreme way they can.
And which arguably they have achieved.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they've definitely achieved it. It's I read a really interesting comment piece by someone who had been arrested, I think, last year. I don't know whether it was with Extinction Rebellion or with another protest. And he actually really regrets his decision not to protest, but to go so far as to get arrested, because he was talking about the fact that actually the waste of resources to get him processed, to have all the signs, all the forms signed, you know, the time that the police took to process all of that could have been put to much better use. And I actually have some real sympathy with what he was saying. I think it's important that we raise awareness of these issues, but I do think there are different ways to go about it. And I think it's really interesting as well, it sort of links back to the children who were protesting, which obviously our magazine covered because that was interesting. Should we, shouldn't we take children out of school and protest these things? And one person who thinks that they shouldn't have been taken out of school, so he's a youth worker, he was saying, look, if these children feel really strongly about it, they should protest it in their own time, which again I can kind of see what he's saying. But then on the flip side they were saying, which again I can also see sympathy with, is, you know, there's not going to be schools if they don't do something about this. And so
by
actually
the very
really
fact
important.
That they are, you know, self-excluding to go and do this is part of making the point. It's their equivalent of what many of these protesters are doing by trying to get themselves arrested by gluing themselves to Waterloo Bridge, which is obviously a slightly stupid, in, you know, for personal health reasons, but nothing else. But, you know, is the aim of disrupting the peace and also making, you know, kind of a real statement. You know, many of the kids that are walking out of schools to do this are doing the same thing. By their absence, they make a greater point to their teachers, their parents, and the governing bodies that surround the schooling system.
I guess my question would be, I think it's undoubtedly an important issue and one that we need to be talking about. But my question would be, what is the best way to talk about this? And I don't have the answers to that. I don't know if protesting, and particularly protesting in that way, is the right answer, but I'm not sure what is.
Sam, do you think the church is responding to this current crisis in the right way? Are they saying enough, not enough?
I think the tendency with anything political, and I appreciate there's some who say climate change is not political, but in my view it has some political ramifications, because we're talking about changing laws, we're talking about, you know, politicians doing something about it. I think with anything political, there can be a tendency to think, well, the church must respond, the church must step up, the church must speak. And I think the truth is that the church has to pick its battles. We have to know where we speak, because we cannot, no Christian, no church, no individual church community, no Christian leader can speak on every single issue. And I think God gives us in different ways. God gives us passions or gifts in particular areas, and there will be some who really, really care about this and feel a sense of calling to protest or to do whatever, and that's fine. But I get slightly nervous when, let's take that issue as an example of someone saying, right, I feel strongly about this personally as a Christian, therefore the church must XYZ. I get slightly nervous because I think, well, you have been called personally to do that. Has the whole of the UK church been called by God to speak about climate change? I would actually argue no. I would say the whole of the UK church has been called by God to do certain things. They include make disciples of all nations, they include baptize people, they include teaching people. I don't see in that I'm not saying it's not important, but I don't see on the same level of that political campaigning on any issue, including climate
but
change.
But we are called to stand against injustice, and I think the thing about
we can't physically stand against every single injustice out there in the world.
But with climate change, I think often we think of just the environmental implications, and obviously we all know that it's not just environmental implications, that often affects the poorest communities, because they're the ones who are impacted by the environmental changes. And I think we often forget that behind the environmental protest it's people that we're campaigning against, it's people that we're protesting against that are going to be hurt. And I see what you're saying, Sam, but at the same time, I don't think it's not like people are divided on this issue, really. Like, from a church perspective, it's not okay, and we need to stand up against injustice. It's not like it's not a controversial issue within the church. It's a straight up, no, we shouldn't be, like, we should be trying to stop climate change happening.
Yes. And I think that interesting point, though, is that around where the responsibility lies and where influencing change can be made. So through these protests, you know, that presents a number of different issues, which are, you know, regardless of what you feel about this specific issue, in this case, climate change, but moreover, the tactics that are being deployed, that does present some interesting questions, because there are other ways of us, you know, kind of supporting these things. Obviously, we've spoken to, you know, on the show in the past to people like Tear Fund and other organisations who in many ways are having to go and now mop up the effects of climate change that are having ramifications around the world, because they see it as their Christian duty to go and do that in terms of relieving poverty that's increased by, you know, kind of bad weather or, you know, conditions or climate change in other places. So, you know, there are different ways of supporting other organisations to solve these problems rather than necessarily going out and marching, as I say, you know, kind of taking a Spider-Man tactic of sticking yourself against a wall. Those types of things can be looked at in different ways. But in terms of the core issue itself, you know, there is, a call for, you know, kind of stronger and more clearly articulated perspectives, not just, you know, come from the church at a large level, but certainly at a denominational level, on what we should be asking people to go out and do. You know, when you have some, you know, in the broad sweep of what our churches look like, you're having some people out there campaigning on one end of the spectrum or the other, that creates confusion in the masses, and there is probably something that we could do better.
I guess what I'm saying is, I just think it also creates confusion if the church, any denomination or the church in general, becomes known for any one political cause more than it becomes known for what the core job of the church is to do. So it's not that I'm saying the church should not care about justice, or the individuals in the church should not campaign, or that we shouldn't have Christian charities campaigning. I'm all for all of that. But I just think we have to be very careful when we use this language of the UK church must XYZ on any political issue, frankly, because I think, you know, it's very difficult for us to be prescribing the whole of the UK church should care about the political issue that I personally am cared about, when I would argue that the Bible has things to say about the whole of society and not just the political issues, important though they might be.
But I do think the church could be doing more, and I say the church with a big capital C, meaning all of us, could be doing more to model stuff well when it comes to climate change. Like the amount of churches I've been to where it's disposable cups left, right and centre and all of that, and they're not recycled, and I just think we could be doing more. Sure, you're totally right, Sam, we can't be protesting on everything, but we can be modelling, looking after the poorest people and our planet better from a church platform.
Well, if you have got thoughts or views on that, we would love to hear them. If your church is doing something interesting in the world of climate change, or if you've got a specific perspective on how we should be articulating this better through Christian media, then we would like to hear from you. Use the hashtag Signal over on Twitter, or join the Facebook group to give us your thoughts. Back with a couple more stories after this.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
And we're back. A couple more stories from this month, and maybe with a slightly more social impact tact. First of all, this is something that I'm sure, as I mentioned up at the top, Ruth is going to get passionate about. This is an article from actually our very own Premier News here, which is that schools and parents need to work together to protect children online, says Christian social media expert. That expert is Dr. Bex Lewis, who we've spoken to many times on the show before, who is Manchester Metropolitan University's social media expert. And she was quoted saying this week that adults must work together with children to help navigate the social media world, and in particular in response to Anne Longfield's study, which was recently conducted and found that many 12 to 15 year olds don't understand the terms and conditions that they're signing up for on social media, and most 8 to 11 year olds don't understand any of them. I don't blame them particularly. That's England's Children Commissioner saying that young people are being left to fend for themselves in the digital world. Ruth, I'm just going to let you pontificate about this for a moment. Thoughts?
I think we were joking earlier that none of us really either read or understand the terms and conditions that we often sign up for, but I really like Anne Longfield's intention that actually we really, at the core of what we're doing, we need to be protecting children and young people. And I think and Bex is absolutely right that it can't just be one people group doing that. It's got to be schools, it's got to be parents. I think it's also got to be youth and children's workers. It's got to be people, like all of us working together. It's that age old adage of it takes a village to raise a child, that actually we should all be. I think often in churches we tend to be quite sort of territorial about our things. We think, oh no, I'm not a youth worker, I'm not a children's worker. Actually, we've all got a duty to raise the children within our churches if there are children. If there aren't, you need to be going into the schools and getting the children, because this is all
dragging
about
them back to the church.
Dragging them back. No, going to where they are, not bringing them back. But it's all of our responsibilities actually to help our children and our young people navigate this. And it's a new world. You know, they're digital natives. They've grown up with all of this. We didn't grow up with all of this. We're still to a certain extent trying to figure it out. And actually sometimes that means figuring it out together.
I agree to a certain extent. And yet I also feel that there is a heavy burden and responsibility on the platforms themselves to make this much more simple for all of us, not just for adults, but particularly for children. Having worked in building social networks for children in my previous job at Lego, you know, I can tell you that making it clear and understandable to kids what they're signing up for is not an easy task by any stretch of the imagination. But the people that are designing these platforms have a burden of care and responsibility to make it clear for them. And I don't think that we should be leaving it up to parents, and as you know, a parent of two young children, thankfully many years below these ages, where we've got to deal with this. I worry, even as someone that works in digital technology, that over years, you know, coming up, that I will find it more and more difficult to articulate to them what they're supposed to do and what they don't, if it's not made more simple. So I think that there is a burden of care kind of question here, which admittedly Anne's report does, you know, raise this need, as she highlights, both that there's a need to rewrite some of these terms so they're easy to understand, and also I think this idea of a digital ombudsman to mediate for children if they want certain posts or photos taken down, which is particularly an interesting issue. And particularly because it also presents the idea that we've seen around this story as well, that there are many kids now who want their parents to take down social pictures that have been shared of them before they had the permission to do so. Before we got recording this afternoon, we were talking about baptism and, yeah, kind of the idea of infant baptism, and that was a general discussion. But you know, that's a decision that many people didn't get to choose, and they have to reconcile it later. This is the same problem happening on social media every single day. So we're seeing that kind of writ large. Sam, what's your perspective on this one?
I find the discussion around privacy really interesting, because you just think how far our culture's changed in the last decade or two. You know, I think back to sort of early days of Big Brother and the social experiment of what would happen if all of our lives became public and we broadcast them on the TV, and most people being quite scared about that idea. And then of course now we're all sitting here with smartphones where we all choose to put huge amounts of our life out there completely public. And I just think there's been such a shift in how we think even about a word like privacy, because those of us of this generation and older, so those of us in this room and those of our parents' generation, will have, I think, very different ideas about whether privacy is even something we value, or how we value it, or how we think about it. We'll probably have a totally different attitude actually to the kids that this survey's been done with. So it's almost like those of our generation writing this story thinking, isn't it terrible these children don't understand about their privacy rights? And I think, but the generation that's coming up, they have a totally different concept of what privacy means, of what level of privacy they should even expect in the world to what we expect. And by the way, I'm not saying this is a good thing. I would completely agree with those who are concerned about the next generation and how they view privacy, and there are huge issues with, you know, photos and all the rest of it. But I do think, you know, is there actually an underlying deeper cultural problem here than just terms and conditions?
But this is where I think conversations need to be had. I totally agree with you, James. We need a digital ombudsman, and things need to be simpler for children to understand. But this is where actually we need to have so many open spaces, whether that's in youth and children's groups, whether that's in the home, whether that's in schools. I would argue that it needs to be in all of those spaces where we can talk about these difficult questions, where, you know, the stats around pornography are horrific. Like 9-year-olds are viewing porn, and that is normally accidental. And
I was going to say, yes, very often accidentally.
Yeah. But that's not to say that it's not happening. And I think, of course, we don't want to be putting ideas into children's head that they don't have. But the sad fact is a lot of this stuff is out there. And so we need to be creating spaces where we're talking about these things and where it's an open place for discussion. And children know that whatever space they go to, it's going to be safe, whether that's the children's worker, whether that's the school, whether that's the parents, that it's an okay place to talk about these things.
Absolutely. Well, if you've got thoughts on this, or, you know, maybe perspectives on how you are raising your own kids to deal with the complexity of online life, please do share that with us. We would love to hear your perspectives, and we'll share them on the show in future weeks. Okay, and the final story of the news today that we're going to look at is one that is, well, if you've been anywhere near kind of a billboard recently, it's been pretty hard to avoid, and certainly online, avoiding spoilers has been a kind of navigating something that's akin to slalom racing. In Search of a Superhero, How Marvel is Fulfilling Our Generation's Longing for Escape is the title of the blog post that was published this week over on Sam's very own Premier Christianity magazine. You can go find that, a fine publication it is, and we thank Premier every month for their support in giving us the studios to come and record the show. Sam, give us your rundown on this. You're not the biggest of Marvel fans, I understand, but
outed me. Well, I get hate mail now.
It's all right. I'm sure you can make up. It's not like there's only 21 movies to go and watch to try and get back up on speed. Let's just dive into this story. How do you feel about superheroes being the kind of model of, you know, kind of saviors for the world and helping us kind of get out of ourselves?
Yeah, well, I guess the classic kind of way that Christians have engaged in superhero films is to try and make all these slightly trite comparisons and say, well, yes, you know, Superman's great, but
it's
Jesus.
Great for a sermon illustration,
Jesus
isn't it?
Is even better. And you know, there was that Superman movie, wasn't there, where he basically died and came back from the dead, and it's all a picture of Jesus. And I don't know, maybe there's a place.
If you've not yet seen Superman, Ruth, then we've got we've talked about your ability to do this before, but
Superman film from about 10 years ago.
It's been out long enough. If you've not seen it yet, then it's your own fault at this point.
I'm not going to explain what Superman is. But yeah, so that has been, maybe I'm being unfair, but I think that has sometimes been our level of cultural engagement with superheroes. Anyway, the piece that you're talking about, James, we didn't really take that tact at all. Instead, I got in touch with a film reviewer, Nathaniel, and he wrote a really... It was actually in the print magazine originally, and then we uploaded it online as well, about Avengers. And he just had a different take to this. And, you know, as a film reviewer, I guess he's probably not the biggest fan of Marvel films in general, including kind of the latest Avengers is what he was writing around. And just saying that, this is kind of classic escapism. But I thought he made a really good point, which was, what do the Avengers actually stand for beyond people not being hurt? Do they have a kind of cause to...
No, it's definitely a kind of rebellion, or it's an extinction rebellion story, essentially. Sorry,
I guess he was sort of saying, as a film critic, it just all feels a little bit lowest common denominator.
I think so, but I think the interesting point that he makes out is that the world is complicated and confusing, but Marvel films are not. Yeah. I'm quoting him from there.
Yeah.
And I think the fact that they do follow a somewhat, some might say, very simple or trite, you know, kind of format, what they do very well is give us a sense of escapism that is actually based around some large moral question in most cases. You know, if you look at all of the different Marvel movies, whether that's Iron Man, about whether or not we should really adopt technology in the world and whether it's good for us because it leads to, you know, every bit of good technology also has a bad use in terms of weapons, for example, or Captain America, you know, kind of like looking back into what we've learned from history of war and bringing that into kind of current 21st century ethics. Like, they're all built around a big, you know, kind of premise, and obviously they're all comic books originally, so they're far more nuanced and detailed in those original material than they ever end up in what can fit into 220 minutes of, you know, kind of Hollywood box office, you know, kind of popcorn fodder. But I think he makes a really good point, is that because they follow those kind of familiar structures with a messy kind of final act, as he says, they actually kind of allow you to, you know, take a step out of what has rather been a crazy kind of time at the moment. And certainly if you map the kind of success of these movies since, you know, kind of, I think it was 2008 with the original Iron Man film, leading all the way up through 21 movies up till now, what is the climax of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, or MCU?
The MCU.
Exactly.
I've done my research, James.
With Avengers Endgame, that is now the most popular film ever to do an opening weekend at the box office, which is just incredible. You know, that is a sign of the times, I suppose, and that we rely upon these movies to kind of get ourselves away and take a break from, you know, kind of all of the...
Yeah, it's classic escapism.
Chaos.
And, you know, I have seen a few of the films and, yeah, I'm not the biggest fan in the world, but, yeah, we all need a moment of escape. Actually, just very quickly on this, did anyone hear Justin Welby's recent interview over on the Sacred podcast? Well worth listening to. But he was asked about what he does to relax, and I was kind of interested in his answers because it was...
Dresses as a superhero.
No, it was things like... It was things
he does
like,
that every day when he gets ready for work, doesn't he?
It was things like listen to classical music and other pursuits. He listed a few of them, and let's just say they're all quite highbrow, let's say. And then right at the end, he was kind of pushed, what do you do to really relax? And he admitted, oh, it's a bit of a guilty pleasure, but I did watch one of those Marvel films the other day. And I just thought how funny that was, that he couldn't just say, yeah, I just watched a kind of, you know, popcorn film, not much meaning to it, just to chill out. You think, we shouldn't be ashamed of doing this. There's room for escapism, and no one should feel embarrassed about going and watching a Marvel film, for goodness sake. We don't want to be so uptight and serious that we can't just chill out and watch a silly popcorn film.
I'd still rather watch a chick flick.
Fair enough.
And for those of you that have been following Game of Thrones for the past 3 weeks, you'll know that that's also providing some rather gorier end of the tale of escapism. But in all of it, and you know, as Nathaniel points out in this piece, escapism is one of the oldest forms of entertainment. But the only difficulty is that the hope it offers is somewhat fleeting. And I think that that is an important thing to kind of draw out, is that we always end up back in the real world dealing with real world problems. But it's good to have a moment to dive into, well, I don't know, something called Endgame doesn't sound particularly hopeful, but I'm sure that there'll be a...
None of us have seen it yet.
But, you know, let's hope that there's more after this if you're into the Avengers. Okay, we will be back in just a second with our recommendations for this month. We've got some really good things for you to be listening to, watching and reading, and we'll be back in just a moment. And we're back now with the recommendations section, the playlist, the things that you should be paying attention to. And I'm going to start this month with Mr. Sam Hales. Sam, what have you got to recommend for us? I believe a podcast that you're a fan of.
My recommendation this month is a podcast. It's Cooper and Carey Have Words. This is James Carey, the fantastic comedic writer, sitcom writer, and Barry Cooper, who is also British but lives in the US. So there's like a UK-US thing going on in their podcast, Cooper and Carey Have Words. And the latest episode I listened to involves them interviewing Daniel Strange, and Daniel is from Oak Hill Theological College, and he's written a brand new book called Plugged In, and it's all about looking at culture from a Christian point of view. And I'm reading the book at the moment, so both the podcast Cooper and Carey Have Words and also Plugged In by Daniel Strange as the book, both are superb. And I just love it when Christians analyze culture from a biblical perspective, from a practical perspective. Here's how we can engage in the world in which we live, and that there's obviously huge implications for media and everything from, you know, should we watch Game of Thrones, to what are the cultural messages that go on in our world. And you know, the book Plugged In has a fantastic endorsement from Tim Keller, who of course is a hero to many for his work in getting Christians to engage in culture. And it's just wonderful to see a British scholar, a British writer in Daniel Strange, just working at such a high level, because we all know about Tim Keller and the Americans, but it's nice to have a Brit who we can really hold up and say, here's some top cultural analysis from a Christian perspective. So it's Plugged In by Daniel Strange, and you can hear him on the Cooper and Carey podcast.
Very good recommendation, one that is fairly recent and relevant. So,
success.
Let's see if Ruth can meet that same bar, which she usually fails to do so.
Ruth, what? Harsh.
Can I first just talk about the conference that I went to a couple of days ago?
You may recommend that in some form. Yes.
It was called Exploring Belief, put on by the Religion Media Centre. So it's the second conference they've done, and it was an interesting day of looking at how the media in general portrays religion, different religions, and actually there was a huge section on unbelief, which felt a little bit ironic at a festival on belief, but it's just interesting, like lots of different people from lots of different religions talking about how like how best they wanted to be represented, how they felt they were represented. Just really interesting. It's worth checking out what they do, particularly if you are working in the area of religion. But I think not even necessarily, you know, we talk about religion if you're working in children's television or things like that, kind of indirectly. So I think it's definitely worth checking out. So that's the Religion Media Centre. I was going to recommend a podcast, but given that you recommended a podcast, can I quickly change what I was going to do?
And will talk it pass about, the censor over here, James?
Let's
see what happens.
A theatre show.
You may talk about
so
a theatre show.
It's a musical that is currently touring.
Just lead that in again for your recommendation.
Okay, so I would like to recommend a musical that's currently touring the UK. It's based on Green Day. You would think, how have they produced a musical? So it's a good question. And it's called American Idiot.
After their very famous album.
Sure, yep. Which I would argue isn't their best album, but still, that's
but
okay.
But their most famous album, you would say?
I think DQ's probably their most famous
it's
album.
It's the only one I've really heard of.
American Idiot.
Yeah. I'd say American Idiot was probably the one that made them break through into the mainstream, shall
Maybe.
We say.
Maybe. I think you'd probably know more.
We may also be showing
before.
Our age of
I'm
what time of music
age.
That we came yeah. through. And, yes, specifically. But yes.
But it's not new in that it's the 10th anniversary tour. So the musical has already been out before, but this is the 10th anniversary tour. And what I think is really interesting, it's a pretty brutal look on, I mean, the album came out post 9/11 as a look on, exactly what it says, American Idiot, the sort of idiocy of some of the American culture and population and some of the decisions they make. And it's kind of a real sort of tongue-in-cheek look at some of the things that Americans do that are not very intelligent, and that's, you know, but they're not doing it in a harsh way. They're sort of looking at themselves as well.
Yeah.
And the musical, in a sense, it makes that even more dramatic point. So the lead character is a heroin addict, and it just shows lots of kind of stupid decisions, and it's just very cleverly done. I mean,
have they updated it at all to kind of give it the new context? Because obviously 10 years, the context of what one might term the idiocy of America,
yeah.
It's probably changed perspective somewhat in that time
yeah,
frame.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there was ever any sort of specific thing. So in that case, in that sense, I think it has stood the test of time. I didn't see the one 10 years ago, so I'm not quite sure. But it's pretty hard hitting.
I guess it's just interesting because at the time they were writing against President Bush, weren't
yeah.
they, really? Whereas now, dare I say it, there might be those who think, well, yeah, Bush was bad, but what we've got in Trump is even worse.
Yeah, well, and I think there
are many that would disagree with that.
Sure, of
yeah,
course, but I just wonder how much
are,
that
I think
comes
there
across.
Are definite parallels,
right.
And I think you could read into it whatever context you're in, probably. It's a pretty hard line opening in that it opens with lots of kind of FU. So it's not an easy watch, but it's quite challenging. It's sort of, I would say, the opposite of the escapism thing that we were talking about with Avengers. It's quite, the word in theatre is Brechtian, where you're kind of made to think about what is going on.
Well, you haven't heard the new opening to the Signal podcast. We updated our music and it's just FU, isn't it, James?
maybe on future episodes we'll determine whether or not to use that intro, but it was very, very kind of you to sing it for us, Sam. So that is the American Idiot tour. It's the 10th anniversary tour of Green Day's show, currently touring the UK through, I believe, looking at through the end of July, ending up at Liverpool's Playhouse Theatre, also
it's
playing in Cheltenham, Aberdeen, Bradford and King's Theatre in between now and then.
It's in Wimbledon in 2 weeks' time, currently in Reading.
Wimbledon 2 weeks' time, there you go. So if that is something that you want to reminisce about your youthful delight in Green Day's music, which I personally would say Warning was their best album, just going to put that out there, that we can dive back into that coming up over the next couple of weeks. My recommendation this month is actually another podcast, one in which you may be able to link to stories that we referenced earlier on in the show. It's actually a show called Holy Smoke. It is a podcast from The Spectator. Many of you may know that The Spectator usually actually does over-index slightly in coverage of religious affairs and particularly Christian perspective on religious affairs from a certain, political lifestyle, I suppose. But the show itself is really fascinating. It's a show called Holy Smoke. It's the most important and controversial topics in world religion, dissected by a range of guests and presented by Damien Thompson. I would recommend there's a couple of interesting episodes which you might like the titles of in recent months. The month before last, Why Are Bishops So Boring? Quite a fascinating discussion. I'm not sure that they necessarily come to a perspective that I would agree with, but there is that's one for you to go look at. They've also covered topics in the past about why Anglicans and Catholics may never unite, and also looked at the story of people who were dealing with cancer and faith. The most recent episode, obviously with coming off the back of a more Easter flavour, is why Bach's St. Matthew's Passion Speaks to Us All, which is actually a really fascinating look at why people go every year, whether they're Christians or not, to go and listen to St. Matthew's Passion, which is obviously this kind of wonderful Bach 3-hour kind of piece played in cathedrals and concert halls all over the world, and just why that grips us so much and why it alludes to the story of the Passion and how that is something that does cut through culture. So I would recommend that this month. It is Holy Smoke from The Spectator. You can go find that on Audio Boom or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you are there checking out Holy Smoke, you might do us a favour by leaving us a rating or a review. If you want to know how to do a review, depending on the podcast platform of your choice, I can't really tell you. It's too complicated, but I'm sure you can work it out. No, actually, if you are listening in the show, please, particularly on Apple Podcasts, and that's where it really helps us, if you would swipe up, hit that 5 stars, leave a little review, that would be lovely. Whether or not you believe we deserve 5 stars or not is up to you, but I would advocate that 5 stars is the number that you should be heading for. And if not, you could also leave us your open and honest critique and thoughts, of course, there in the review as well. And that brings us to the end of this month's episode of Signal from Christians in Media. We would love it if you would come and join us at one of our upcoming events, as I mentioned at the top of the show. You can find out all of the information about those at christiansinmedia.co.uk. You can get tickets for our upcoming sessions at Carlton House Terrace on the 27th of June. That's the most upcoming event in the calendar over on Eventbrite, and you can find all the information you need for that on the website. But for now, that brings us to the end of the show, and I want to thank my wonderful co-hosts as they join me every month, the Dame.
Oh, good. I thought I'd lost my title.
No, we're going to stick with the title.
Thank you.
The Dame Ruth Jackson. And Mr. Sam Hales as well.
It's been enlightening and convicting as always, James. Thank you.
He will last one more month until we use that F-bomb intro, and I'm sure his position, much like the Cabinet Secretary, will be reconsidered. Okay, and that brings us to the end of this episode of Signal. We'll see you again next month, where we'll discuss all the things that are going on in the world of faith and media from Christians in Media. Thanks.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.